All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuck, Nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. I'm broadcasting from a room. I'm not at home. I'm not in my garage. I'm out in the world. I'm out in the Midwest. Am I in the Midwest? Is Madison, Wisconsin the Midwest? Is that the definition of Midwest? I believe so. How's it going with you? Let me promote this podcast, if I may. Today, I'm going to talk to Trombone Shorty, all right? His name is Troy Andrews, but as you can tell by the stage name, he's a master trombone player and also plays trumpet, drums, organ, tuba. He's been playing in concert at Jazz Fest in New Orleans since he was like 4 years old, and he started touring with Lenny Kravitz right out of high school. He's been on The Simpsons and Sesame Street and is one of the highest profile ambassadors of New Orleans music, and he's got a new album out called Lifted, and it's very good. It was weird listening to it because I remember it kind of struck a note in me, a chord in me, the horn chord. Because I remember it really is sort of a rock record. But I remember when I was a kid, there were big horns. There were big horn rock bands: Chicago, Ohio Players, Average White Band, Tower of Power. There were big horn bands that were, yeah, they were R&B to a degree, or maybe soul, but it definitely crossed over into rock. But it reminded me of that. I had not heard in recent days the horn section on what's basically, it's a mix of stuff, but it's rock. Rock horns, baby. But I got to talk to Troy about that music, that source, the eternal well of music that is New Orleans. It was exciting. It was a lot of stuff I didn't know. So that's going to happen. That's going to happen for you shortly. Tonight, I'm in Milwaukee at the Turner Hall Ballroom. Tomorrow, I'm in Chicago at the Vic Theater. And Saturday, I'm in Minneapolis at the Pantages. Also, another thing, I'm most likely trying to postpone or shift my Dynasty Typewriter dates because I've been offered a role, a part on Reservation Dogs, which is a show that I think is brilliant and exciting, and I'm thrilled to be part of it. I don't generally ever cancel stuff, but fortunately, it was a hometown series of gigs that can be, you can see me in L.A. almost any time, but I will try to reschedule those for you. In a couple of weeks, I'll be in Pittsburgh at the Carnegie of Homestead on May 12th, Cleveland, Ohio at the Mimi Ohio Theater on May 13th, Royal Oak, Michigan at the Music Theater May 14th, Washington, D.C. at the Kennedy Center on May 20th, Red Bank, New Jersey at the Count Basie Center on May 21st, and Philly at the Keswick Theater on May 22nd. There's some more dates coming in the future, but those seem to be enough. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for ticket links and other info. All right? Is that all good? Is everything all right? Now, if I could just stop worrying for a few minutes. I landed in Chicago. Not a great drive, Chicago to Madison. Nothing that appealing about it. But I am happy to be here. Had lunch with my buddy Ben Sidran, the jazz pianist and jazz author. We talked about the stuff. He's a bit older than me. Talked about mortality. We talked about horn players. We talked about Steve Miller, who he was in a band with in college. He corrected some things. Corrected is a nice word. I would say that it came up kind of organically, but he was like, yeah, that Steve Miller interview. I'm like, yeah. He's like, yeah, maybe I'd tell you a couple of things. So that was nice. You know what's nice is to know that resentment springs eternal. You know, if someone fucks you, you're going to remember it. That's one thing I've learned from myself and talking to other people. No matter how much peace of mind you have, or no matter how much you've let go, if somebody screws you a certain way, it'll stick, and it'll stick there for the lifetime. And it's not always right up front, but you know, it ain't far. You don't have to dig too deep for it. People who have been divorced know about this. People who have been fucked over financially. Yeah, it's one, as my dad's mind sort of disintegrates, I guarantee you the last thing to go is going to be some version of fuck that guy. I have to wonder how many people's last words are like, you remember that dude that did that thing? Fuck him. Resentment springs eternal, depending on what the injury is.
you know, trauma, I think if it happens young enough, will sort of, you'll mold your whole personality around trauma. But when someone fucks you, it's just, it's right there. It's like, you know, it, you know, the, those weird flames that, that just never go out that you see in the night at those, whatever those factories are. Like, why is that fire still on? Oh, that is, he's mad at somebody and it's never going to go away. Because they're never going to pay and there's nothing you can do about it. But just watch it. Just watch it. You can turn it up or you can turn it down. But the flame is eternal. Fuck that guy. I got one of those. Maybe two of them, I think. Actually, it's more, there's nothing I can do about it. Here's the other problem I have. I've just stopped the, and this has happened before. This is just some element of anxiety. I don't know if you have it. And I'm driving, man. I'm driving down the highway, so I have time for this. I have time to think about it. I'd like to think I'm reworking stuff, and I'm going way back. I'm almost doing some version of mobile EMDR on myself. Where since I have time, I've got the highway spread out in front of me. I got the car, and I've always thought that driving is meditative because you can. What's interesting about it is you. Some part of you stays grounded as you sort of go off into the life of, you know, I guess it's really not meditating because it's something, it's processing. You can process in the car. You know, if you turn the car off, there's still some part of you has to drive the car so you're connected. And there's something about that. It's almost something like, it's something like the EMDR thing in my mind. Because with the EMDR treatment, you know, you have these buzzers that, you know, kind of, get you into a different place so you kind of I don't know, they can go into some part of your mind. The motor part of your mind gets sort of distracted with the buzzers. But I think that the car serves that purpose. And I'm just making this up. So I'm going over past points in my life that I thought were horrendously embarrassing, painful, or terribly traumatic. That's sort of how I spend my time sometimes in the car, working through that stuff. And then kind of following the thought process and trying to figure out whether or not I still have sort of unprocessed feelings about those things. And that's how I spend time in the car. And then whatever time that I'm not doing that, I kind of, you know, listen to music or I worry about things that haven't happened. So it's great. You know, the car is just great to be like, all right, what am I going to do today? How about listen to some Talking Heads, process some very painful stuff from childhood, and then think about, you know, one of my cats dying while I'm not home. Great. What a fun ride. And then maybe we'll get some coffee so we can really sort of turn the heat up on that process. Fuck me. Jesus Christ. But I like it, man. Once I get out, once I converge on the point, and I'm happy to say that I'm a little lighter and my heart is a little lighter because on the road from Chicago to Madison, I processed a nice chunk of childhood trauma with my mobile version of EMDR locked into the engagement with the car. I was free my mind to sort of stop and start the process of making connections of feelings and getting myself into the place of the trauma, moving through it with the help of knowing that I'm grounded by driving the car and then sort of like feeling the feels. And yeah. And then I got here and I had lunch. It was a lot of processing. I worked up a nice appetite. Had some sweet potato hash with a cup of poached eggs and a biscuit, and ate some of Ben's potatoes as we talked about the weight of consciousness. Good morning. I don't know when you're listening to this, but how about why don't we talk to Trombone Shorty? His new album, Lifted, is available tomorrow, April 29th, wherever you get your music. And those horns will lift you. Jesus Christ. I should listen to it now. Jazz helps, man. Music helps. It seriously helps. I don't know why, but I've listened to Talking Heads' Fear of Music almost daily for weeks. What is it about that record? There's some, it's speaking to something of the time. Give it a listen. There's something relevant to it outside of life during wartime, which is the time. I don't know. I just can't stop. I know it's a great record, but out of nowhere, that's the one that I'm spinning constantly. Anyways, Trombone Shorty, brilliant musician, brilliant I mean, horns, man. That horns, that's where it's at. That'll lift you up. And this is me talking to him back in the garage. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. It's great to meet you, man.
Great to meet you too, Mark.
It's interesting because do people call you Troy?
Yeah, Troy, Shorty, Trombone.
Shorty?
Trump, some guy by my dad, I would just say, hey, Mr. Trump. I was like, Mr. what? Yeah.
Mr. Trump?
Trump, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's weird because when you were brought to my attention, I'd heard of you, but I didn't know the music. And then I thought like a trombone guy. Well, I want to talk to a trombone guy.
Right.
Because I listen to jazz, right?
Right.
And I just had this weird breakthrough. And this is usually how it works with me before I talk to somebody. Because I listen to a lot of bop. I listen to hard bop. I'm no scholar. But I pick up what I can. I have a lot of records.
Yeah.
And I started realizing after listening to your stuff and listening to specifically people who are honest to New Orleans jazz.
Yeah.
That what evolved out of that, which is everything.
Everything, that's right.
But New Orleans jazz as a form is inclusive.
Inclusive, that's right.
Right,
that's
but right. Once you get to bop, it's sort of like, what are they trying to do? Get rid of me?
That's right. That's it, yeah.
Because when you really think about jazz as a culture in the 50s, what it became, you know, in New York and L.A. or whatever, with that crew of bop guys, you know, you really had to be, you know, in the in crowd or have a mindset to take that stuff in.
Yeah, you had to do that.
Right. But with what you do and what you come from, it's like everybody's welcome and it's clear from the first note.
From the first note, that's right. New Orleans, we never forgot that music is dance music, you know.
Yeah.
It's a celebratory thing to us.
So yeah.
Like you say, it's everything.
Right.
So we play, when I went to school in New Orleans, the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts.
Yeah.
They were teaching us the bop stuff and all that. But I didn't learn anything about New Orleans music there. But me coming from the neighborhood that I came from to where we got drums and tubas and beer bottles and stop signs or whatever we can jam on, it was very difficult for me to see when we started to play this other music in school that no one were reacting. I was born into people dancing.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing because you did go, you had to kind of backload that stuff, right? That wasn't what you were listening to.
No,
you were listening to everything that you were coming up from. And I want to talk about the early stuff, but I do want to say before, you know, I listen to the new record. I listen to all the records, but I mean, am I wrong in thinking that, you know, this is the one where it really came together for you? This record.
I try to do that for every one of them, but I think we went in the studio with the mindset of let's play like we're on the stage, but let's make sure it's tight.
Right. Because I felt that the vision of the record and the consistency of it and the amount that you put the trombone forward, I mean, you do because that's what you do.
Yes.
But in this one, you're like, it's time for my lead.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking more of how Lenny Kravitz would take a rock solo.
Right.
That's where my mind was.
Because you could feel that. Like in the other records, you're blending a lot of stuff. There's a lot of different kind of styles going on, but in this one, there's a consistency.
There you go. Yeah,
right to the way you laid the record out, and then like there's definitely a point where because you wonder about that with a trombone in general. So like, it feels like a support instrument.
Yeah, that's what it is. Most of the time, but in New Orleans, it still is a support instrument because you'll have someone like most trumpet players have a sidekick trombone player.
Right. Okay. You know,
Louis Armstrong.
Yeah,
he had that.
He had a guy.
Yeah, he had a guy.
Who was his guy?
They had Tyreek Glenn.
Uh-huh.
He did some stuff with a guy, Trummy Young.
Uh-huh.
There's a bunch of trombone players, but normally, out of that whole thing, the trombone is the side man.
So it's almost like it keeps a bass almost.
It tailgates around and just play around a melody that the trumpet player is
right,
singing.
So the trumpet's like, beep, 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 right. And you're like, boom, 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 boom. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
You're just tap dancing right around it,
uh-huh.
And hitting at the melody every once in a while.
So when you, tell me about that, because like, again, yeah, I'm an appreciator of music, but I'm limited in what I know, you know, what I know about, you know, New Orleans music, and like I know a Zydeco a bit. I know Dr. John. I know the Meters. I know Alan Toussaint.
Neville Brothers
a bit. And I know the people. Mm-hmm. Professor Longhair.
Oh yeah, you're deep now.
Yeah, that stuff's great.
Yeah, yeah.
But like I don't know about the history of that of the neighborhood of Treme and what, you know, what it means to grow up there. You know, like I mean I can see it on TV or I can get a sense, but I have to assume that that community, like it feels like not only is it tight as a community spiritually and just as a neighborhood, but that the music was everywhere all the time.
Absolutely.
That's true.
That's very true. I grew up there and I remember being a kid walking to elementary school.
Right.
I went to school in the French Quarter, which there's one block that separates the French Quarter and the Treme.
Yeah.
That's Rampart Street.
Yeah.
So the French Quarter is only about 3-4 blocks from the Treme,
where
I lived. And I remember going to, walking to school, and there would be a funeral, second line jazz procession.
That's what it's called?
Yeah, yeah.
Second line, yeah.
Where people are dancing in the streets, and we sing about it. And I would be going there, and I'll see that. And then when I'm coming back home, there's someone celebrating a birthday.
Right.
And then the backyard playing.
Yeah.
And then my family, we had the Rebirth Brass Band and the Dirty Dozen.
Rebirth
Brass Band.
I remember the Dirty Dozen Brass Band.
Dirty Dozen. So they come after Dirty Dozen.
Okay.
And they were very influenced by them. And it was always music. And so my band, my cousins and family members, we'll get home, do our homework.
Yeah.
And then we'll start practicing and bothering the older musicians. And then we...
Well, what was that? So... Like, it was just an assumed thing that you were going to be a musician? I mean, could, you know, like, it was just, that's what happens?
Most people, there's a lot of musical families, so I never had a choice, but I think when I was born, they gave me some drumsticks or something like that.
So how far back does the music go in your family? I know there's a popular accent that I don't know, but who are they? Like, what's
your family,
legacy?
It all started with my grandfather, who's Jesse Hill.
Okay.
And he made a song back in the 60s, Ooh Poopa Doo.
Yeah.
And he was it was a big song back in those days. And
when you could write a song and call it that,
yeah, call it that, Ooh Poopa Doo.
Yeah,
and it was a big song during those times. I think Tina Turner covered it, a few other people covered it. So, but that was before me, of course.
Yeah,
and then on his
did you
side
know
of
him?
Him? Yeah, I knew him, but he was much older by the time he wasn't really active. By the time I was starting to go, but he would come over to rehearsal and try to tell us some things when we were trying to get it together.
So that was a pop song.
Yeah, it was a pop song. Yeah,
so
it was a big song.
Right. By the time he's going at it, they're taking it. Like, that's the interesting thing about New Orleans and that whole world is that all American music, most of it, comes from there.
Yeah.
You know, and if it doesn't, it eventually mixes with that.
That's right.
And it comes from, you know, it mixes with country, becomes something.
That's right.
So, like, at that point, he must have been pretty close to the source and just figured out how to make the groove into a pop song.
Yeah.
Like Fats Domino.
Yeah. So my grandmother's brother was Walter Nelson. He was Fats Domino guitar.
Oh, really?
Guitars, yeah. But that was before my time. So,
I know, but you must have, did you grow up with the records?
I grew up with the records, yeah. Still today, I still listen to them, and they always say, oh, you got to listen to this particular song and this and that. And so the music lives in the whole family, and we listen. We grew up on Ray Charles. My grandmother loved that. And Fats Domino, of course, Dr. John was like an uncle to me.
You knew him?
I knew him very well. I grew up underneath him, and he would come over by my grandmother's house and hang out and eat gumbo and red beans, and I would play with him on the road, do some things. Yeah, he was like a real family member to us.
John, Mac Rebinac.
Mac Rebinac.
Yeah, because like he was another guy where, you know, I sort of locked in and I got all the old records. I had Dr. John's Gumbo, which is a relatively hard record to find, which is weird because it's a later record and it's him covering a lot of stuff. Like he does Ico Ico, he does, I think, Tipitina
and Big Chief. And,
And it's a great record.
Yeah.
But those old ones where he's sort of like taking it out there, right? With Night Tripper and the first three records.
Yep.
I can't remember the names of them, where he's, because you listen to it, and he's like, he's fusing that time, you know, drugs, the 60s, whatever trip he's on, and he's like elevating that New Orleans thing into a psychedelic shit show.
That's right. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And but it is still fundamentally New Orleans music, right?
Yeah, yeah. You hear the dirt underneath it. You got the big dirt and the street sounds and the everything.
You do that on the new record a lot. There's always guys talking. There's, you make sure that every song, it's like, what are we doing this? What are we, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that's just what we do.
That's a part of it?
That's a part of it, you know, because if you think about the second line culture where I'm from, where I grew up in, there's thousands of people around you speaking. The band is in the middle, but everybody's dancing and having conversations about what, where they're going next, or what song they want to hear the band play. And we just hear a lot of chatter while we're playing in the street.
Yeah.
So I wanted to capture some of that on this record and get that atmosphere going.
And what does Second Line mean exactly? Where does that come from?
Well, at first it comes from, they had the funeral procession.
Right.
And then...
Oh, the regular, the sad one.
Yeah, the sad one.
Okay.
There'll be the band and the coffin. And then the second line is normally people that join in from the neighborhood.
Oh, okay. I see. Okay. So the... Because the first time I saw a New Orleans funeral procession was in a James Bond movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think it was Diamonds and... I can't remember which one it was.
I saw that.
Remember they killed the guy in the street and then they wrote the coffin on and they pulled him up? And
I think that was... I think that was either the... The Olympia Brass Band that was in that.
Oh,
one.
Really?
I think so.
Well, I think it was. Was it Diamonds Are Forever? It was a Roger Moore James Bond, and it had to do. And I know, like, there was a lot of, like, you know, kind of probably slightly racist voodoo stuff in there.
Yeah. That happens too.
Yeah. But I that's the first time I put together that there was this culture.
Yeah.
That was celebratory.
Celebratory.
Well, I mean, even in I think in some of the language that you've been quoted in talking about your mother's passing, which I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You said she a transition, right? Is that what you said?
It's a transition. She gone and to a better place. But it's always a celebratory transition in New Orleans. Like, it's very, of course, people will cry in New Orleans, but then we turn it around really quickly.
Yeah.
So we might start with a dirge.
Right.
And you'll see everybody falling out because that's emotional. And then the drum kick off. And now it's a big celebratory second line thing.
Sending them off.
We're sending them off. Yeah. Huh. That's what we do. And we got a part where we doing a procession, the carriage with the coffin in it. We'll separate half of the band, some of them on this side, some of them on the left, some on the right, and we call that cutting them loose.
Right.
That's when you send them, that's the final thing.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, but the second line is dealing with the funeral, but it's a different thing. So we have the social aid and pleasure clubs that parade every Sunday.
Uh-huh.
And that's a different thing. That's not a sad
thing. Okay.
It's just New Orleans culture.
Right.
Yeah.
But it does but your first memories of it are around funerals, I guess.
Both of them.
Right.
Most of it happened in my house and in my backyard with my brother James Andrews and his band.
What's he play?
He plays the trumpet.
Yeah.
Yeah, he comes.
You can play trumpet too, right?
Yeah, I play trumpet too. On my show, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, both of them, trombone and trumpet. But so that it happened in my house, and then I think I got introduced to the funeral, just going out there playing inside of him.
I guess the connection I'm trying to make is that there it just seems like this is the way emotions are expressed, relieved or entertained. Like the language of music is directly related to life in a very immediate sense.
Absolutely. It's very spiritual.
Yeah.
You know, when you go into Treme or in New Orleans and you see people, we can be having a second line parade down the street and you'll see somebody come out of their house. They were just fixing supper or something, and they'll come out banging on the top of their pot and just start to dance and leave the house and forget.
Yeah.
And just join in. That's how emotional it is.
And that's real life.
That's real life. That's every day.
I mean, because, like, you know, you think, like, I think I saw that in a movie, but you're telling me that's real life.
That's real life. That's what I see. And that's and what I was a part of.
It's a community thing. You're not putting on a show for anybody.
It's not. No, we're not putting on a show. You know, some people may hire the band to play for their birthday party.
But I mean, generally speaking.
Yeah, no, it's just for the community. And we go out there and we play. You know, if some cameras are there, cool. If not, we still do what we
do. Right, right. But it's not a tourist attraction.
No.
This is pre-existed all that.
That's right. Pre-existed all that. We do it every day.
I kind of feel like, you know, like after a certain point, like you think of the French Quarter and you think, I've only been there a few times, you know, and I, you know, I got the powdered donut and the coffee.
The beignet, yeah. You're making me hungry now.
But you know, there is an intrinsic tourist culture to that city at this point, right? But it seems like when I was there, you cannot, nothing's going to turn out New Orleans. You know, like it's like there's plenty of tourists there. But you're still sort of like, we're just visiting.
Right.
And you don't feel like it's like being, the city's putting on a show. That city has got some vibe to it.
Yeah.
Where you're like, if you stay there too long, you're just going to be absorbed by it.
That's what happens to
you. No, I see people.
Yeah, they come down and they end up moving there for some reason. It's magical. But like
it is magical.
I always tell the people, go hang out in the French Quarter, get that out the way. Even though it's a tourist attraction, it's still real, you know.
Right.
We just there. So I said, go hang out in the French Quarter and call me after that. Then we'll get into the other stuff.
Because like I know that there's a balance there, too, to that energy, that there is a magic to it, but there is a darkness to it. Yeah, there's a weight to that place.
Absolutely.
I don't know what it is, but, you know, I imagine that, you know, growing up there and dealing with music, that you're pushing back some dark spirits that exist there, because I'm sensitive to that shit.
And, well, you know it. If you're sensitive to it, then you can feel it.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Do you?
I don't know. I think it's
but you
a
know
part
what I'm
of
talking
I know,
about?
I know what you mean, yeah. You know, the spirits are very much alive there.
Yeah, it's something. Yeah. Maybe it's because they keep all the dead people up over the ground.
Yeah, yeah, necropolis, they call it, necropolis.
Yeah, they're just there. They're not, you know.
You know, sometimes I'll be with some people, and we'll go by the cemetery.
Yeah.
And they'll naturally start to be quiet as if we're going to disturb the dead.
Yeah.
It's a weird feeling, but it's incredible.
All right, so you're a kid, and you got all this around you. And, you know, obviously you're a gifted guy. I mean, you're the guy. You're the new trombone guy. You're carrying the horn for everybody now. But how does that reveal itself? I mean, because there's footage and pictures and you know, recordings of you with that trombone, and, you know, you're like a little kid.
Yeah, 4 years old.
And it's bigger than you are, and you're just laying it out. Why that instrument, and when did you realize, or whoever realized around you, that, like, this guy's special with this thing?
Well, this goes back to I was telling you about having a sidekick.
Right.
So my brother's a trumpet player.
Yeah.
So I guess in the house we didn't need any more trumpet players.
Yeah.
So they put a trombone there, and I stuck with it.
Did they just give it to you? Who gives it to you? Who says, like?
It's either my mom or my brother, but it was around the house. So because they are my cousins and my brother playing music, the instruments would stay at my house.
Right.
And it would be like my playpen.
Right.
I would crawl inside tubas and drums and stuff. But I think once my brother took over and wanted me to play music and stay on his side, the trombone was the thing that he kept me with.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's just his influence of the city. Trumpet players are always the kings, you know, leading the band. So he put me on the trombone.
Right.
And maybe he needed a trombone player in the band at that time.
Well, it sounds like it. I mean, that's the traditional place for the trombone.
Right on side the trumpet player.
And how's does he have a recording career, your brother?
Yes, he has a few records out.
What style is he?
He actually some of his best music he did to me is with Alan Toussaint produced it.
Yeah.
So he has a record called Satchmo of the Ghetto that he did back in the 90s in his
future. Toussaint, that's how you say it? Alan Toussaint. Toussaint.
Yeah,
Toussaint. Not
Toussaint. No, Toussaint. Toussaint. Yep. And it's featuring, actually on that record, he has Alan Toussaint playing piano and Dr. John on the organ.
Oh, wow.
The whole record.
And what's your brother's name?
James Andrews.
Oh, man.
And he was a part of the Newport Brass Band, too.
He's still around?
Yeah, he's still around.
All right.
Yeah, he's only like 52.
Uh-huh.
He's still around.
And he plays just all the time?
He plays in the city a lot, and he comes to jam with me whenever we can in the city.
It seems like the people that are in that community, like you just say, like your brother and then, you know, Alan Toussaint and Dr. John, they're like, all right, let's do it.
Yeah.
Right? It's like that easy?
It's that easy. Let's do it. Let's just go in the studio and let's record. And
right. You know. You're with your brother. You're five?
Four.
He's how old? He's how much older than you?
I think maybe 16 years or something.
He's 16 years older than you?
I think so.
How old are you?
I'm 36.
Okay. Yeah. So he's a lot older than you. So yeah, But so was there like, so you're playing trombone and he's playing trumpet and yeah. He's, you know, and he's like 20 when you're four.
Right.
So was there a novelty approach to it too? Like in the sense of sort of like, look at this kid.
No, because he didn't, I was up there. I don't think I could really play that well at that age.
Because, you know, like Derek Trucks.
Yeah.
Like he was one of those kids they put out there. He's like 11. And he's like doing all the Dwayne Allman part. But he had to reckon with the fact that like if he's going to stay in it.
Yeah.
At a certain point, he's like, well, I can't be this novelty act.
Right.
This kid who's got this one trick.
Right.
So he had to figure out how to be a genius. On his own.
He's incredible. We did a few shows together.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. But my brother, my brother allowed me and taught me on the spot.
Okay.
So
he knew trombone or he just knew horn or he just knew music?
He just knows the trumpet.
All right. So
I learned by ear first.
Right.
So he would play in my ear and I would play it back to him. But as all of those years of that, I just kept getting stronger and stronger and better and gaining more knowledge.
Right. So, just from playing.
Yeah, so I didn't have
and listening.
Yeah, so I didn't have a trick at first.
Right.
So it's just me trying to learn
figure
and
it
play
out.
And then it just developed over time. But he couldn't tell me what to play on the trombone. He could just play it for me on the trumpet and I would have to
figure it out. And you figured out how to do all this on your own?
Yeah, I figured out by standing next to him.
But there was no trombone player that just said, you got to do this with your hand?
They had a few of them that I stood next to and there's pictures of me looking up at him trying to figure it out. But my arms were so small, I couldn't go all the way out extended on the horn. But so I stood next to a lot of great trombone players on the street and I just listened to them.
Do you have guys that you like? Like, I don't know a lot of my, but I think I've heard some J.J. Johnson stuff. Mm-hmm. I think he used to play with bop guys, right?
There are
a couple of bop guys, right? A
couple of people, yeah. I listened to him when I was in school.
Yeah.
It hit me to him.
That's so funny. It's like, like you spend your whole life playing music, and then you go to this school, and they're like, here are the guys that took what you're doing out in this way other direction.
Yeah.
Who were the guys that you grew up liking? Trombone guy.
I like Fred Wesley.
Okay.
You know who that is?
No. What's he about?
He's the one that was behind a lot of James Brown music with Maceo Parker.
Okay.
But he was like the first trombonist that was into putting it on funk music.
Right.
So,
okay.
Yeah, with that whole thing.
And that, how old were you when you started getting hip to that? When you knew those guys, were you listening to it? Were you like, I got to learn some shit from this record?
Well, I always heard James Brown in the house.
Right.
Because my family and everyone listened to it and loved this music. But I wasn't listening to the horns at that moment. I was just checking out James Brown and everything that the sound was
coming. That's a good point. Yeah.
And so as I got older and my ears started to grow a bit more, I started to focus on that. And then I met him and talked to him and we recorded and done some things together. And he's a nice person.
Yeah?
Yeah, Fred Wesley.
Well, it's interesting because it seemed like as I was thinking about talking to you that there is a difference between like what evolved out of like R&B horn sections were punctuation, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And then it somehow evolved into a more elaborate lyrical presence in music as it became, you know, more funky and more, almost aggressive. And I've forgotten, you know, after while I was listening to you, I'm like, I'm 58. I grew up with something like this. What is it? And then you realize, you know, through the 70s, there was like a bunch of really heavy horn bands.
Yeah.
Right? Tower Power, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Chicago.
Chicago, that's right.
Ohio Players. I mean, like, this, like, the history, the legacy that you're coming from in terms of bringing this stuff together, it's there.
Yeah, it's there.
Right, like, because I started to realize, like, this is, there's a familiarity to this.
Right.
Which is good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you haven't heard it in a while.
Right, absolutely.
I can't remember, like, you know, listening to this record, it was reminiscent, but I can't remember the last time I heard, like, a power horn band like that.
Well, that's true. I didn't think about that. Well, it's natural for me. I always hear it, especially in New Orleans, but...
But to put it all together with that stuff, with the guitar and all.
Yeah.
But going back, when do people start taking notice? How old were you when I watched that picture, that video of you playing with Wynton? When did he take notice of you? How did it evolve that you became prominent?
Being in New Orleans, Wynton would come back and see us playing, and then he'll take us.
Where at?
All over the street or wherever we may be.
Wynton was just walking around the streets with his brother and his dad.
His dad. Well, it was always some type of musical thing that was going on, and he would be in town for
so
that.
So he was like a big supporter.
Yeah, he's a supporter. Yeah, he
of the community in general.
Of music, yeah. Yeah.
So when he finds you, what does he say to you?
Well, we were playing New Orleans jazz, New Orleans music, so.
How old were you?
I was probably around 5 or 6 that we were. I met him and
Was the outfit you were with the band? What band were you with?
I was probably with my brother's band.
And what were they called?
It was the All Star Brass Band. And we were just playing street funk.
Yeah.
Brass, but it's part of the New Orleans thing.
Yeah.
And so I've been knowing him since that time.
Yeah.
But we're a little bit more loose and
yeah. And but he brought you out there. What was that? Where was that done? Where is that that thing taking place?
That was somewhere in Europe.
Yeah.
I think it was probably in Jazz of Vienne in France.
Did he take you out there with him?
No, I was with my brother's band. And he knew that we were there, and he invited me to play the last song.
When you said, how old were you then?
I don't know when that video was. I was probably like 13 or 14.
So when that happens, by that time, you can riff? You can improvise?
Yeah. I mean, we grew up improvising in New Orleans. And when I got to the Noka school, it was very strange for me that people were playing other people's solo, because that's not what we did in Treme.
Yeah.
Like, when you hear people like my brother, Kermit Ruffins, if they're coming down the street 5 blocks away, we can tell which band it was by the trumpet player sound.
Right. Really?
Yeah. Like, if Reebert was coming up the street, we knew the language that Kermit Ruffins was playing on top of all that. And we could be like, oh, it's Reebert.
Yeah.
And when they come up the street, that's exactly who it is. So So we learn to improvise first.
How you get your own thing, your own point of view, your own sound.
Yeah, you get your own sound and you're developing and speaking. You know, like I speak with my New Orleans accent and you speak how you speak. So that's how we think.
If I keep talking to you, I'll be speaking in the New Orleans accent by the end of the thing.
Yeah, I'll have
I'm
you
just
together.
One of those people.
Yeah, we'll get you together.
So that's interesting, because that approach gives you a voice.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, because I always notice that in music in general, that there are people that can copy other people brilliantly.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're kind of lost when it comes to expressing themselves.
Yeah, they don't know who they are.
Yeah.
It's all stuff. Now, don't get me wrong. I like
technique.
Technique.
Right.
And you know, but don't get me wrong. I like to listen to a lot of music. And once you listen to something like you just said, you'll be speaking like a New Orleans accent. That happens to me in music. Like, whatever I'm listening to, without trying to copy it, it'll be in my...
You'll absorb it.
I'll absorb it, yeah, like a sponge. And it'll naturally come out some type of way. But I'm not copying anyone. I just learned enough lyrics, or it just touched me that much to where... It's just coming out.
Well, also, you grew up at a time, you know? I mean, you know, it wasn't like you were... isolated.
Right.
I mean, you're getting all the music coming in from when you're growing up, because, like, this record, the new record, Lifted, it's as much a rock record as it is anything else.
Absolutely.
And I have to assume that, you know, despite the roots and this sort of, because I think everyone has a perception, a kind of like, you know, almost this romantic idea of that New Orleans music just stays the way it is forever. But, you know, there's music going on all the time.
That's right. And we're influenced by everyone.
Right. And I think you pull it in on this record for sure. Yeah. I mean, you got Gary Clark on there and you got your regular guitar player, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. And what the beautiful thing about New Orleans is that we have this New Orleans music, and then we have subgenres of New Orleans music. So, I mean, we have like New Orleans funk, which is the Neville Brothers and the Meters. And then you like have New Orleans rock, which is like... Cowboy Mouth and Better Than Ezra and things.
Okay,
Then we have the street brass.
Yeah.
And you have subgenres of that. You have a traditional type of brass, then you have people that's more street funk, which is Rebirth and 30 Dozen.
Right.
And then you have like Preservation Hall. So we all fit under this New Orleans umbrella, but we all speak a different language. And it all comes together. So even in the city, not musically speaking, we have people that's in certain neighborhoods that when I go to visit my family, they have their own lingo, their own language that I don't understand.
And what, the musical language?
No, just
general.
Regular, in general. So Some people are very influenced by their neighborhood.
Yeah,
and then
sure.
We all meet up some type of way, and we have this common thing underneath that's New Orleans, but we all speak a little differently.
Yeah.
To where I go to my cousins in the Ninth Ward, and they're saying something that I'm like, I don't know what y'all are talking about.
Yeah.
And so they're influenced because they created that. They all hear each other speak.
Yeah.
And some people stay in that neighborhood for 30 years.
Right.
And they don't go anywhere.
Yeah, that's a little weird, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but it's weird, but that's what happened.
Yeah.
And so I go down there and I'm listening to them, and they even play the tambourine differently.
Right.
You know, you might have some people uptown that play with their fingertips, and when you come downtown, they play with their knuckles.
Yeah.
And the Mardi Gras Indians. It's just small little things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
That's big. You know?
Right. It makes a big difference to the sound.
Yeah, to the sound.
I noticed that with washboard players.
Yeah, washboard players. That's right.
Where you're like, everyone's got their own style in that washboard.
That's right. Everybody got their own styles, you know. Some people play with spoons. Some people have the gloves with the metal tips
yeah,
on them.
Yeah.
So it's different things, but it's all one city.
Right.
So at some point, we influence one another. So some things that I learned in the Ninth Ward that I didn't know, I find a way naturally to bring that to the Trim 8.
But you're not necessarily, but you're not necessarily conscious of it.
Right. It's just an influence.
You just pick it up.
You just pick it up.
And
yeah.
Then one day you're like, oh shit.
Right.
I'm doing that thing that I
right.
got.
That's
yeah,
right.
yeah.
That's right. So we'll reference it like, oh man, let's play this beat like when we doing something like play it like a Hot 8 band. That,
right.
They're from uptown.
Yeah, yeah.
So they got the different, you know, you once you come down there and you see it, you'll be able to tell. And
yeah.
You're there for a while, you'll be like, oh, that's an uptown
yeah.
thing. And then I'm from downtown. And you could see, like, if I show you some videos, you could be like, oh, they by people's second line, which is a dance in New Orleans, but it's all improvised.
Right.
You know, but it's all the second line.
But it's been going on long enough that there's style to it.
There's style to it.
Right,
so
right.
We could be like, oh, this guy's from uptown, and then you could see how smooth the downtown
yeah,
is.
Yeah.
And you could just tell by the way they approach their dancing.
Right.
And
right,
and we all 5 minutes away from each other.
That's wild.
But the influence of the neighborhood is so impactful.
Well, isn't that something to do with the, like, there isn't a representation with, like, again, I don't know the history mm-hmm. of the costumes, of Mardi Gras costumes, but isn't there a history of slight differences around those costumes that have been going on for generations?
Yeah, yeah, well, you
like
know,
the Chiefs?
Yeah, the Chiefs, and the story, they always have a story that they're needle and threading on there.
Okay,
so
yeah, yeah.
The Mardi Gras Indians are just it started as a tribute to the Native Americans that helped slaves.
Uh-huh.
So this is the way that the black people in New Orleans paid tribute to that culture.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
And then it became what it is today.
Right.
But yeah, there's always difference. And they get in the street and do real battles.
Yeah.
Back in the day, it was very, very dangerous. People,
really?
Yeah, they might not make it home.
Like, but this was a celebration?
Well, this is Mardi Gras, but it is a celebration, but like you say, there's some darkness to it, you know?
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful thing with that culture. So you'll have people from downtown, the Mardi Gras tribes, the Mardi
right.
Gras Indian, you have people from uptown, and they'll walk, and they'll go down the street, and some type of way they meet up, and then it's a real battle.
That's interesting.
But they Indian singing.
Yeah.
And they're telling stories. They might say something about this guy's suit is raggedy or whatever.
Oh, right,
then
right.
the other guys say something. But back in the day,
yeah,
you have real hatchets come out and people, you know.
So that's an aggressive game of the dozens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. But it's
say?
All right now. It's all yeah. right now.
Well,
it's
no. Like, right. Well, yeah. But I think the point I was trying to play at is that there is sort of a cultural tribalization around, like, the music,
mm-hmm.
like, everyone, like, that's passed on through traditions yep. in these communities. And then even though it's 5 minutes away, it's like a whole different language
of
music, too.
Exactly. That's what I was telling you.
Right. And in this record, it seems like, you know, you can really feel that you're pulling in, at least from, you know, from rock, funk, you know, straight up New Orleans jazz and you know, other, you know, hip-hop, R&B. Like, mm-hmm. it's all... Like, I listen to all the records,
mm-hmm.
but this one, I'm like, I can see it all.
You can see it. Yeah.
Yeah, and also, I think it's great because you just step up. The trombone's leading this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
whereas
yeah.
before, I felt more like you were conducting.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
Is that true?
Yeah, yeah, you got it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah, you're on it.
So... How do you evolve out of your brother's band? You guys okay? Does he, you and your brother?
I think we're okay. Yeah.
He's not jealous?
No, no. You know, he'll just come on stage. I'll just hit his trumpet playing.
Yeah.
Like, I uninvited sometimes, but his big brother, he'll come on stage and start playing. And then,
really? At a gig?
I'll just look to the side and he's walking out. and now we have to do like a little fake battle.
Oh, okay.
You know, but no, he's good. He's a wonderful person, and I have to give him a lot of respect and love, because without him, I don't think I would be here today.
Of course, yeah. So who was the first major star that kind of used you, brought you on stage?
Well, to me, it was probably the Neville brothers, Aaron Neville.
Yeah.
And then from there, well, actually, when I was four, I was brought on stage by Bo Diddley.
Yeah.
When I was four, I was so small, I don't know what I was doing. But, yeah. And then I played with a few different people.
Did you talk to Bo?
I don't know.
I don't remember.
I was like four. I think I was a little nervous or scared, because they crowd surfed me to the stage. I'm like this little kid, and they're like,
with the horn?
With the horn. My mom like, hey. And they put me on stage
with
him, and there's a picture of that. But when I was 18 or 19, I graduated high school, and I joined Lenny Kravitz band for a few years.
Now, was this, like, when you talk about the education you were getting around jazz, when did that happen? Was that in high school?
No, so there's this educator, Kid Jordan. He's an educator. He's taught a lot of musicians.
Uh-huh.
So at the time that I was playing with my brother's band, Kid Jordan found me, and they had me in summer programs.
Okay.
My whole life.
When you were starting at like 5 or 6? Or?
Probably around 8 or 9.
Okay.
During that time, I started to go to the programs with him and he was teaching that at SUNO, as a Southern University of New Orleans. I would go to there every Thursday.
Yeah.
And play with like all ages.
Okay.
College students.
Right.
And so I was taking lessons with him. And then there was a guy, Clyde Kerr and Kent Jordan, who taught me at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. Those guys are the most prominent people in my education.
Interesting. So you come up with all of this sort of natural talent and street talent from family and watching.
Yep.
And then these guys are like, this guy's got it. Let's teach him what's up.
That's right. So they wasn't concerned. They weren't concerned with me playing. They wanted me to understand what I was doing, to be able to speak the language and get in the books.
And read music?
And read music. And
so that's where you learned all that?
All that with them, yeah.
And how did you take to that? I mean, did you fight it, or were you like ready? Because like, it seems like learning to read music when you know how to play music, be like, what do I got to do that for?
No. I mean, I was so young that I was, and I'm always excited to learn new things.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what kept me going. Like whenever I learned something and I was able to go back to the Treme neighborhood and play it in front of my friends or use it in that type of setting.
Integrate it,
and I was able to do it. It made me even more excited.
I think you just, in a diplomatic way, define showing off.
Well, to my friends, so they would play, because we all battle each other. So whenever I learn something, that's how we got my cousins.
That's how it goes? You go at each other?
We go at each other all the time, you know.
And try to out-riff each other?
Try to out-riff each other. You know, some things that we play, like some of my cousin and I, like he played the trumpet, he could play very high.
Yeah.
And then I got to a level to where I was able to play very high. So we'd find ways to try to play melodies very high on the trumpet, but we all in the same band, but we riff, like, you know, like basketball players.
Sure.
If you go learn a new move or something, you want to go show it off.
Right.
So when I was learning stuff, because they didn't go to Noka with me, so
right,
they stayed in the street and natural.
So you came in and you came and showed them, and you showed off, but you also gave them a gift.
That's it. Whenever I learned something, I would go play it. And while we're battling in the backyard or whatever, I would play it and be like, check this out. And then I would break it down to them and show it to them, and then they play something. So that's why I was always excited to learn something, because some of my friends didn't take the journey with me to go learn music. So I was able to bring it back to them.
And make it understandable.
And now, by the end of whenever they practice, all of us are getting better.
Right.
And I'm able to bring that knowledge that I'm getting over here to them.
That's great. Yeah. But I like how it comes out in both teaching, but also in battles.
Yeah, it's battles.
Healthy competition.
Yeah, healthy competition. And we still do that. You know, if we go in the street, if I take you in the second line in New Orleans, there's a 10-piece band, another 10-piece band. Even though we're all playing the same gig, there's divisions. So we have the first division and the second division. And the second division is normally the most popular headlining band.
Yeah.
And at the end, so there's this thing. So we parade for 4 hours.
Yeah.
I don't do it anymore. It's been a long time. But So we parade for 4 hours, and there's like these 10-minute breaks where people get food and stuff. But what'll happen when the band's supposed to take a break, we take that moment to line up and face off.
Yeah.
And so you got thousands of people that's with you and thousands of people with the other band, and we going at it.
Wow.
Sometimes at the same time.
How many members in the band?
It could be from 8 to 10, 12 people.
How does that break down, a brass band like that, a classic one?
So we got probably 2 trombone players, maybe 3 trumpets at most, no more than 3.
Yeah.
A sax player, and you got snare drum, bass, sousaphone, that we call it a tuba.
Yeah.
And but now they're starting to have like 2 tubas on each side to get more power.
Yeah.
You know, so but we'll face off. It's so fun, you know, and we all friends, so after that we'll be like, yeah, y'all got us on that first.
So that's where that tuba. That's funny. Yeah. So that's where that tuba comes from. It kind of like, because I mean, you know, the Roots got a tuba.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And that's a New Orleans thing.
That's a New Orleans thing. We put a tuba on anything. You know, you see a washboard player, he got a tuba player. You know.
Well, I wonder where does that come from. The Germans brought those things over, I think.
Yeah, yeah, the European instruments.
Right, because like you know, all those horns, you know, in the German and like the accordion and stuff, you know. It's so funny because, you know, when the Germans came, I don't know how they came or why they came. I think it was, but I know it was in Texas and it must have been New Orleans. But what the Mexicans did with it and versus what the people in New Orleans did with what the black people did with totally different things.
Totally
man.
Different things.
Because, like, for some reason, the Mexicans gravitated to the polka. You know,
That's right.
And then, but in New Orleans, it became something else. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah.
It must have been more primitive melodies.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, that vibe right there.
Yeah, that's it.
That's what we were feeling.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And that's where the swing comes from. While the Mexicans are boom, boom, boom,
boom, boom, boom, boom. Yeah, that type of thing.
Wow.
But it's all, that's regional. That's what I was, that goes back.
That's it.
It goes back to that, the neighborhood.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
in New Orleans.
For sure. And how it integrates with whatever the dominant music is.
That's right. That's right.
So, all right, so. You do all this, you learn about this stuff. Now, do you feel proficient? Like, I guess because it seems like the traditional horn or the traditional New Orleans horn band thing, it's kind of 1-4-5 trip, right? It's a blues trip.
Right, right. It's blues. Mostly, right?
With a couple added kind of ragtimey. I don't know what you call it.
It's in there, but that's very old now.
Right.
Like, now the music is influenced by modern hip hop and R&B, so there's a lot more changes to that. But that type of thing, it's what we hear in the French Quarter,
right?
More touristy, that type of a 1-4-5 thing.
But that's sort of on the basis of that rock one. That one, what's that one that power rock one on the record that's almost got like a whipping post riff to it?
Standing Here.
Yeah. You know, that like that's a straight up rock blues trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
And you used Gary?
Gary Clark.
Yeah, I've talked to him.
He's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, an incredible person and an amazing musician.
Sweet guy, right?
Yeah, sweet guy.
He's a good guitar player.
Yeah.
But where's that going with this? So, I know. So, like, when you're learning about this other kind of jazz, now, can you hold your own in a bop outfit?
I can go up there, yeah.
Yeah?
I mean, that's what they taught me at the school.
Yeah.
And
what's the primary difference?
I mean, you know, like, in New Orleans, like we were saying, you hear more Louis Armstrong, is more dancing.
Sure.
It's more for the people.
Yeah.
And then when you go to play the other stuff, is you're really playing for the next musician next to you.
And they're barely listening.
Right. Well, they're listening, but the crowd might not be listening.
But it's just so funny when you see those guys, the horn players in the bop outfits.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, like if Shorter's going at the sax,
right.
You know, Miles is just smoking a cigarette. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like just waiting.
Yeah.
Wait, there's no trying to perform. No one's dancing.
Nobody's.
We're going to wait.
We're just waiting for you to finish your expression.
Exactly.
But I learned, that's what they taught us at that school. Mm. You know, a lot of people went to the school. Harry Connick, Branford Marcellus family, actually.
Yeah.
Ellis Marcellus, may he rest in peace. He taught there before my time. Terrence Blanchard, John Baptiste, everybody goes through that, and they teach us that. So we can get up there and do that if that's what we want. But when I was there, I didn't coming from where I come from, I was excited to learn the language.
Right, but you didn't feel it.
I didn't feel it, but I learned it because I'm always a student and I love learning.
Sure.
So if we had to do that, we can get up there and do it.
So when you go out with Lenny,
Like, how does that happen? And what do you, like, is that where, I mean, how does he decide to use a trombone?
Well, you know, he comes from that 70s thing that we were talking about with Earth, Wind, and Fire.
He had
horn players before me.
Okay.
I think I may have been the first trombone player in this band, but he always had a sax and a trumpet.
Right, okay.
But by me playing boat, he was like, oh, we got it.
I'm trying to remember the songs with the horns.
Yeah, we got Mama Said.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. So he's doing
it. Ain't Over Till It's Over.
Right.
So he does that, but also on the songs that don't have it, he allowed us to make some arrangements and make our own parts on it. But during that time with him, it was... I knew that I would continue to be a musician, but I didn't know. I was already discovering rock and playing with people in New Orleans that was playing that type of music. But while I was at Noka, I was listening to like Cash Money Records and No Limit Records and Nine Inch Nails and Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
So I was always interested in that.
So you were trying to figure out how, like, I guess what the real question becomes, it's like, if I don't want the life of a sideman, you know, what am I going to do?
Well, I was really trying to copy off of my brother who was a front man.
Yeah.
But who is a front man. But I wanted to, because I had so many other influences of what I was hearing and what I was a part of, I just needed to figure out a way to all put it together in this gumbo.
Right. But you decide to sing at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, because you can sing and you do sing.
So I couldn't sing at first. My band and my brother and a great legendary New Orleans musician, Deacon John, and he was like, man, you should sing. And I'm like, at one point I was even afraid to even introduce the band on the stage, you know. So I learned over time and I got more serious about it. But at first I was a little too nervous. But they told me, look, if you do this, you can reach many more people.
Well, that's interesting about singing, because like I performed last night. I'm a comic, and I've always played guitar, but like I was always afraid of singing.
Because
it's embarrassing and vulnerable and weird.
It is. It's a strange thing, you know. I'm telling you, like I would early on, I just would like point to the band members and say thank you. I was just so nervous, but I see my brother do it all the time, and I was like, well, if I want to be like that, I better start doing it. And then, of course, Dr. John, he has his own personality. I was like, well, I can do that.
Sure. He's no virtuoso singer.
But he got his thing.
Yeah,
you know?
And that
made me more comfortable listening. I'm like, oh, that's cool that he has. When you hear that.
You know it's him.
You know it's him.
Yeah.
So,
So he was hanging around your family all the time?
Yeah, like, way before I was even born.
Yeah.
He was a part of the family. Yeah.
That's wild, man.
Yeah.
Because he's such a character.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's just like, it must have been nice to know him as a dude.
It is.
He lived a long time, too.
He did. He would call me on the road and check up on me.
How you doing? How'd he talk?
Man, how you feeling? We were in the studio, and he was like, look, I got to go, but put a little trick knowledge on there for me. You know, he always had some sayings that sometimes I didn't catch it until 5 minutes later. But it was always wonderful to be around him. I've been so blessed to be able to come up under a lot of legends that's not here with us and learn.
One-on-one. Like who's some of the other ones?
Of course, Alan Toussaint.
Sure. He just passed not too long ago,
Yeah, he
right?
passed not too long ago. There's the Neville Brothers.
Yeah.
I grew up playing with them since I was like 13 years old. So I've been able to be influenced. Yeah. So like I was telling, going from Noka, I had another parallel experience of playing with these guys.
Right. So like
active mentorship. Learning on the spot, being on the road with them. And also, so that the goal, I mean, I guess the challenge there was to keep the natural ability and the connectivity to the people, and also learn his other technical ability.
Right.
Because I had some friends that went into the school with me. They had so much fire, but by the time we finished, they were technically proficient, but they didn't have no soul anymore.
Right.
So they
lost it?
They lost it. It became too technical.
Technique?
Yeah, too technical, too book-wise.
Right.
You know? And I was like, wow. But I'm glad I was able to keep that. I think I kept it, but I...
No,
it
seems like you have a sort of commitment and a growing vision of what you're doing, you know, but it's open.
It's open, yeah.
And also, I think it seems that you have leadership qualities. I think that in the sense that, like, you know, maybe the same thing that made you nervous about singing or whatnot made you very aware of what was going on with all the instruments.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? So because you have to, like, you're clearly, you have to be a band leader at some point if you're going to put that stuff together.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're doing the arrangements,
that's
you
right.
got to be like, this is how this goes.
Well, you know, and you have to be a student too. So I had to do a lot of studying with different people and and watching people. So when I do go back with my band, because I had at 7, 8 years old, I had my neighbors across the street, Sammy and Wayne. We put together this brass band. As I told you, we were trying to imitate the people in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
We burdened my brother. And I took them across the street, not being able to technically speak to them at that age, but I taught them how to play the bass drum and the snare drum of what I was hearing in the family. And from that time, they started to grow on their own. And then I was always the person in the group. So we had a bass drum and snare drum, then me on the trombone.
Right.
But then we didn't have a trumpet player. Then the guy down the street could play the trombone. So I would play the trumpet.
Right.
And then we finally got a trumpet player, but we didn't have a tuba player. Then I switched to tuba.
Yeah.
And so I played all the instruments in the group. And it was a beautiful thing. Now that I'm thinking about it, I didn't realize that we were really developing and doing some things together. But I wasn't able to speak, but I can teach them the way my brother taught me at that age.
Right, and out of necessity, you were able to kind of, you know, take on all the instruments, so it gave you a very nuanced understanding of what to expect from those instruments.
Absolutely, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
So, like, you can play any kind of horn that's got that mouthpiece on it, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I haven't tried a French horn yet, but I had one.
How could you not have just tried it?
I had one when I was younger, when I was learning, but I'm about to order a bunch of horns and just play around with them.
Oh, really? Just to have them around?
Just to have them around.
Now, what are there different types of trombones? I would notice there's a couple of different types
of trombones. Yeah, you got the standard trombone, alto trombone, which is a little small. You got an F attachment, which you see in classical music a lot.
What is that?
It's an F attachment. You ever see where the guys have like a lot of pipes?
Yeah. What is that?
So that's like, they use that in classical because you can, so we can get certain notes, you can just hit it. So if I'm playing really fast and I want to get a C, I can get that's 6%. I can get it in a first position where I was stretching my arm.
I
can just hit the note here. So you might have like a fast riff.
Do you feel like that's cheating somehow?
No, not at all. I have one of them. It's not cheating at all. Yeah, because you can only do 2 or 3 notes, but it's like if you're like, instead of going all the way out.
But usually just use a straight, regular, standard trombone?
Yeah, I'm just regular. Yeah. I got to be rock and roll on that one, yeah.
So when you go out with Kravitz, that seems like it's right around the time that Katrina hit.
Yeah, it's a couple of months after I joined the band.
So you're away?
What happened? So I was in the band. We had just started the South America tour, and we were out for a couple of months, and I went back home for a 2-week break. And during that 2-week break, a 3-week break, Katrina hit. And I had to get back on tour without knowing where some of my family was. We still was trying to locate people and different things. Yeah. So, but thank the Lord that I was in that band at that moment because I was able to make a living.
Yeah.
With a superstar.
Yeah.
Playing arenas and different things. And later on when things started to settle down.
Yeah.
We were doing an American tour. I think it was Lenny and we were playing on the road with Aerosmith.
Yeah.
So we were doing like a co-build thing. He was opening up. And one good thing about that is that we traveled all over the United States and most of my family and friends were displaced and everywhere.
Really?
So
the whole neighborhood got flooded out.
The neighborhood. My neighborhood of Treme is close to the French Quarter, which is the highest point of the
right.
city.
Right, okay.
So we had some water in that neighborhood, but nothing that was topping the house like it was in the Ninth Ward.
Oh, so you got lucky.
Yeah, we got lucky. We just had to change some floors and some wooding around.
And you found everybody?
We found everybody, yeah. We found it. It took some months, but we found everybody.
Months?
Yeah, some people, you know, maybe about a month or so that we didn't hear from everyone.
Oh.
And after about a month or two, we started to know where everyone was.
Well, and did you find that did it change any... Like you're already close to the city, but did that change the necessity of how you feel about the city?
No. If anything, it made everyone from New Orleans realize that we had a magical, special place.
Yeah.
Because I was telling you before Katrina, there were some people that never left their neighborhood and even seen the rest of New Orleans in 30 years. So,
yeah.
So that just made us feel closer, and we just hug it a little tighter.
Yeah. So this record, you know, I read some of the press. You know, you had your mother in mind in the title, Lifted.
Yeah.
When did she pass away?
November, a couple of months ago. My grandmother, February.
Yeah.
Right after that.
Yeah, and did you play at their funerals?
Of course.
Yeah?
It was very hard. It's very hard to perform. But I've probably played hundreds of funerals being in New Orleans, but that was probably the toughest.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But I played all the way to the end.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Does it help, like, I guess in the same sense, well, Jews, they do a week thing. It's a week long. You don't do much of anything. You know, you don't work, you don't do nothing. It's different. You reflect. But I imagine that the spiritual element, with the support of the family and the other musicians and everybody in the community that knew the deceased, that, like, once you get done with that playing, that you feel some relief, I imagine.
Yeah. You can see it and feel it. So, as soon as someone passes away in New Orleans that was a culture barrier, a musician, that week things happen.
Yeah.
We do a whole week of parades only for, like, culture barriers, the people, musicians are people that kept it along. But you'll see it's a sadness, and then once we start playing and we finish it, it is a sign of relief.
Right.
The music takes us there, and then we got through it because we've been dealing with it all week. But we don't sit down and sit in a dark room.
Right. It's like an immediate way to deal with the trauma of grief.
Yeah.
Because grief, you know, it comes and goes, man. You know, you can't manage it. But I imagine just that sort of, like, here you go.
Here we go.
Giving it to the sky.
That's
or whatever.
It. That's it.
Wow. So this record comes out. It's out. It's not out yet.
No, it's out on April 29th.
Yeah, man. It's like the whole thing just plows along.
Thank you. Yeah.
It's all the horns too. Who's the producer on this?
Chris Seafried.
And you record this at your own place?
Yeah, in New Orleans. I got a place we call Buck Jump, which is another word for second lining. We like to buck jump out there.
Oh, Buck Jump. All right.
Yeah. And I bought the studio from Better Than Ezra.
Band. Yeah, I know those guys.
Yeah, so they had it for many, many years, and I was recording in there, and they said that they was getting rid of it. And I told them to have whoever call me.
Yeah.
And then we started to talk.
So it was already set up?
It was already set up. Of course, I did a little remodeling to get it up to date and different wiring and different things, but it was already ready.
And they're New Orleans guys? Better Than
I don't
Ezra?
Think they're from New Orleans, but they started their career, or at least they've been there for 20, 30 years.
Huh.
So they're part of us.
Yeah. Right. But that's interesting, though, because like you were saying earlier, it gives you the option to be, if you have your own space and you got the keys, you can get an idea and call someone in the middle of the night.
Absolutely.
And say, let's work out this riff.
That's
or
it.
Or whatever.
And that happens.
It does.
Yeah. I just called my engineer. And I call my guitar player. Or sometimes, normally, I'll just go by myself, and then I'll try to create all of the instruments by myself, and they'll come in and play it much better than me.
Right.
But like on the record, we did a song, Might Not Make It Home. We were actually playing at the House of Blues for an event for the school that I went to, a fundraiser. We probably got off at midnight, and I had this vibe in my head as soon as I got off, and I just told the band, hey, man, y'all all right? Like, let's get something to eat.
Yeah.
And we went to the studio and we started the session about 2 a.m. and we recorded that vibe.
Really?
Yeah.
And you got it?
And we got it. We just stayed there until like 6 in the morning. I got skylights in there so the sun started to come out, but we were in the thing, and that's the beauty of having it. I just had to make sure none of their girlfriends got mad with me from them not coming home right afterwards, you know.
Make sure they understood where they were.
Yeah, they understood. Yeah. They could, you know.
Yeah, we're working.
We're working, that's right.
Well, that's a lot better to have that than to try to get it on your phone.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
I want it. Sometimes when I get ideas, I can't sleep until I got at least the music 100% complete.
Right.
So I have to do it right there and be able to feel it in a few hours of taking home so I can move on to the next idea on top. So we went in there to record it as if this is the end.
Like, right.
This is what we need to do. Like,
oh, yeah,
can't
yeah,
touch
yeah.
nothing else.
Yeah. Right. Well, so you said that, like, some of the other records, you know, you get kind of meticulous about, you know, how everything needs to be in the studio. And in this record, it's more, you know, it's more informed by the energy that you guys get when you're live.
Absolutely.
So what'd you have to do to stop yourself from over, you know what I mean, from
being meticulous,
or just overproducing it.
Well, we did it. Well, we learned the music and then we performed it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you performed it live
in the studio,
right?
Yeah. So I like, let's learn it. Let's see where we are. We did very, very little overdubs, mostly like tambourines and horns.
Really? Yeah. So with all that, how many guys in your band?
I got 10 people in the band, 12, but only 3 or 4 of them was on this record. Like we used one drummer. I got 2 drummers. We used 1 drummer,
yeah.
Bass guitars,
yeah.
Organist, and the other guitar. And most times I played Fender Rhodes and just auxiliary.
What are all the horns?
Me on tuba,
yeah,
trombone and trumpet. And we had a baritone sax and a tenor sax.
So you did 3 horns?
I did 3
horns. So you're saying you just played the basis, the core of the songs live?
Yeah.
And then you layered it on.
And then we put the horns on. Huh. But we played together.
Right.
So because the studio is not that big, we could have done it, but I let the rhythm section, which is the drums, bass, keys, and guitar, they played. And maybe I was singing a scratch vocal just to guide them.
Yeah.
And then me and the horns, we went back in there and we played it live on top of, so we can get the same room sound.
Yeah, that sound, that horn sound, you jacked up those horns,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I do a lot of doubling and tripling, so we'll play the line.
That's great, yeah.
And then we'll play it again.
Yeah.
Then we'll play it again. But sometimes when you're recording horns, especially the saxophones, you'll get a phasing thing when you double it.
Uh-huh.
So what we'll do is, when we double, sometimes we'll switch parts. So whatever the sax played on the first one, I would play that on my trombone, and he'll play what my trombone is playing.
Okay.
So we got the same chord and the same sound.
Yeah.
But the texture is different.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot. And, you know, I think, like, it's timely because it seems to me that, like, something's happening within hip-hop and R&B that there is a kind of slightly retro movement going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Right.
You know, like with Silk Sonic and shit, where you're kind of getting back to that type of R&B that was a little more easy listening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
Right? And so maybe, like, you know, it's time that, you know, renewed interest in that kind of 70s horn band thing. Because, like, really, when I'm listening to it, I'm like, this used to happen a lot.
Right.
And it
doesn't
happen anymore.
That's right.
Yeah,
maybe I'm in the wrong time.
No, maybe your timing's perfect for now.
That's right. Yeah,
because all of it comes back around.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's new and different.
It's new and different.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Even like Sly, man.
Sly Family Stone
does big horns.
Yeah, big horns.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I haven't heard anything like it in a long time, and it's totally its own thing. You're not, you know, it's not drawing from anything, but it was just sort of like the whole presence
of
the horn band.
Right.
Hasn't been around in a while.
That's right.
It's time. That's what I'm saying.
No, it's definitely time. Hopefully we lead in the pack so we could get some more.
Yeah. So, but what do you do? Like, do you, because I know you have some, do you teach? Do you have a school? Do you have a foundation?
I have a foundation, and we have an academy that's connected to the foundation.
Oh, yeah.
So we, every Monday night in New Orleans, after school, we get a bunch of children and we teach them. I hire a lot of local musicians because I'm always on the road, so I can't be there. So I'll drop in when I can, but we put some of the older musicians people my age and a little older and younger to work to teach the kids.
Yeah.
So in the program, not only do they learn music, but they learn music business and audio engineering.
Oh, wow.
So at a young age, I wanted to make sure that those kids had all the tools and nothing was foreign to them. So when they... Because let's be honest, some of them not going to continue to play music.
Yeah.
Some of them going to go into the music side of business. Or,
that's okay.
Yeah, and that's, but it's all in entertainment business. So we try to give them everything. That way when they become professionals, none of this is completely new to them.
Right.
Because there's
it's good. Yeah. It's a good option to not, you know, to integrate their understanding of what it takes to make music.
Yeah.
At recorded music. Because, like, if somebody's not great or they lose their esteem as a musician, they can at least say, like, well, I can put my talents in this other area.
And it's still in the same arena.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
that's
we wanted important. To give that to the kid.
Yeah, because we don't need any more bitter musicians around.
No, we don't need that at all, please. Yeah, we got a lot.
Plenty of those.
Yeah, somebody told me, they said, you know how to get a musician to complain. And I say, how? They say, give them a gig. I definitely experienced that with some people. I'm like, man, you know.
What are you, working?
You was at home just chilling. Now we on the thing. And okay, all right. Yeah. You know.
And then you understand why they don't get work.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they don't understand.
Of course not. Yeah. Yeah. It was good talking to you, man.
Same here, man. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Trombone Shorty. That was exciting. I learned a lot, and I like that. I like learning about music. All right? And I like that guy. And I like the new record, Lifted, which is available tomorrow, April 29th, wherever you get your music. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for the dates. I'm going to go to the Walgreens because I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. I want to go. Got to check out the Walgreens because I like Walgreens. That's what I do on the road, man. Let's go look at the travel section. Travel section time. No music. Go listen to Trombone Shorty. Boomer Lives! Monkey and LaFonda. Cat Angels everywhere. Cat Angels fucking everywhere, man. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.